rubble and rescuing trapped people, and I want all the Masons and Wrights to work with him." Looking at the monks, he was relieved to see his trusted confidant, Milius, unhurt. "Milius Bursa is responsible for moving the dead and injured out of the church, and he will need strong, young helpers. Randolph Infirmara will take care of the wounded once they're out of this mess, and the older ones can help him, especially the older women. Right, let's begin." He jumped down from the altar. There was a hubbub of speech as people started to give orders and ask questions. Philip went over to Alfred, who was looking shaken and scared. If anyone was to blame for this, it was he, as Master Builder, but this was no time for recriminations. Philip said, "Divide your people into teams, and give them separate areas to work." Alfred looked blank for a moment, then his face cleared. "Yes, right. We'll start at the west end and clear rubble out into the open space." "Good." Philip left him and pushed through the crowd to Milius. He heard Milius say, "Carry the wounded well clear of the church and put them on the grass. Take the dead bodies out to the north side." He moved away, content, as always, to trust Milius to do the right thing. He saw Randolph Infirmara clambering over the rubble and hurried after him. They both picked their way across the piles of ruined stonework. Outside the church at the west end was a crowd of people who had managed to get out before the worst of the collapse and so escaped injury. "Use those people," Philip said to Randolph. "Send someone to the infirmary to fetch your equipment and supplies. Have a few of them go to the kitchen for hot water. Ask the cellarer for strong wine for those who need reviving. Make sure you lay the dead and injured out in neat lines with spaces between them so that your helpers don't fall over the bodies." He looked around. The survivors were going to work. Many of those who had been sheltered by the intact east end had followed Philip across the rubble and had already started to remove the bodies. One or two of the injured who had only been dazed or stunned were getting to their feet unaided. Philip saw an old woman sitting on the floor looking bewildered. He recognized her as Maud Silver, the widow of a silversmith. He helped her up and led her away from the wreckage. "What happened?" she said, not looking at him. "I don't know what happened."
"Nor do I, Maud," he said.
As he returned to help someone else, Bishop Walloran's words sounded again in his mind. "This is what comes of your damned arrogance, Philip." The accusation cut him to the quick, because he thought it might be true. He was always pushing for more, better, faster. He had pushed Alfred to finish the vault, just as he had pushed for a fleece fair and pushed to get the Earl of Shiring's quarry. In each case the result had been tragedy. The slaughter of the quarrymen, the burning of Kingsbridge, and now this. Clearly, ambition was to blame. Monks did better to live a life of resignation, accepting the tribulations and setbacks of this world as lessons in patience taught by the Almighty. As Philip helped to carry the groaning wounded and the unresisting dead out of the ruins of his cathedral, he resolved that in the future he would leave it to God to be ambitious and pushing. He, Philip, would passively accept whatever happened. If God wanted a cathedral, God would provide a quarry. If the town was burned, it should be taken as a sign that God did not want a fleece fair. And now that the church had fallen down, Philip would not rebuild it. As he reached that decision, he saw William Hamley. The new Earl of Shiring was sitting on the floor in the third bay near the north aisle, ashen-faced and trembling with pain, with his foot trapped under a big stone. Philip wondered, as he helped roll the stone away, why God had chosen to let so many good people die, but had spared an animal such as William. William was making a great fuss about the pain in his foot, but was otherwise all right. They helped him to his feet. He leaned on the shoulder of a big man about his own size and began to hop away. Then a baby cried. Everyone heard it. There were no babies in sight. They all looked around, mystified. The crying came again, and Philip realized it was coming from beneath a massive pile of stones in the aisle. "Over here!" he called. He caught Alfred's eye and beckoned him. "There's a baby alive under all that," he said. They all listened to the crying. It sounded like a very small baby, not yet a month old. "You're right," Alfred said. "Let's shift some of those big stones." He and his helpers began to move rubble from a pile that completely blocked the arch of the third bay. Philip joined in.
He could not think which of the townswomen had given birth in the last few weeks. Of course, a birth might not have come to his attention. Although the town had got smaller in the past year, it was still big enough for him to miss such a commonplace event. The crying stopped suddenly. Everyone stood still and listened, but it did not begin again. Grimly, they recommenced moving the stones. It was a perilous business, for removing one stone might cause others to fall. This was why Philip had put Alfred in charge. However, Alfred was not as cautious as Philip would have wished, and he seemed to be letting everyone do as they pleased, pulling stones away without any overall plan. At one point, the whole pile shifted dangerously, and Philip called out, "Wait!" They all stopped. Alfred was too shocked to organize people properly, Philip realized. He would have to do it himself. He said, "If there is someone alive under there, something must have protected them, and if we let the pile shift, they could lose their protection and be killed by our efforts. Let's do this carefully." He pointed to a group of stonemasons standing together. "You three, climb the heap and take stones from the top. Instead of carrying them away yourselves, just pass each stone to one of us and we'll take them away." They restarted work according to Philip's plan. It seemed quicker as well as safer. Now that the baby had stopped crying, they were not sure exactly where they were heading, so they cleared across a broad area, most of the width of the bay. Some of the rubble was what had fallen from the vault, but the roof of the aisle had partly collapsed, so there were timber and roof slates as well as stones and mortar. Philip worked tirelessly. He wanted that baby to survive. Even though he knew there were dozens of people dead, somehow the baby seemed more important. If it could be rescued, he felt, there was still hope for the future. As he hefted the stones, coughing and half blind from the dust, he prayed fervently that the baby would be found alive. Eventually he could see, above the heaped rubble, the outer wall of the aisle and part of one deep-set window. There seemed to be a space behind the pile. Perhaps someone was alive in there. A mason jumped gingerly up the pile and looked down into the space. "Jesus!" he exclaimed. For once, Philip ignored the blasphemy. "Is the babe all right?" he said. "I can't tell," said the mason. Philip wanted to ask what the mason had seen, or, better still, take a look for himself. But the man recommenced clearing stones with renewed vigor, and there was nothing for it but to continue to help in a fever of curiosity. The level of the pile came down rapidly. There was a large stone near ground level that required three men to move it. As it was rolled aside, Philip saw the baby. It was naked and newborn. Its white skin was smeared with blood and building dust, but he could see that it had a head of startling carrot-colored hair. Looking more closely, Philip saw that it was a boy. It was lying on a woman's bosom and sucking at her breast. The child was alive, he saw, and his heart leaped for joy. He looked at the woman. She was alive, too. She caught his eye and gave him a weary, happy smile. It was Aliena. Aliena never went back to Alfred's house. He told everyone that the baby was not his, and, as proof, pointed to the child's red hair, exactly the same color as Jack's. But he did not try to do any harm, either, to the baby or Aliena, apart from saying he would not have them in his house. Aliena moved back into the one-room house in the poor quarter with her brother Richard. She was relieved that Alfred's revenge was so mild. She was glad that she would no longer have to sleep on the floor at the foot of his bed like a dog. But mainly she was thrilled and proud about her lovely baby. He had red hair and blue eyes and perfect white skin, and he reminded her vividly of Jack. No one knew why the church had fallen down. There were plenty of theories, however. Some said Alfred was not capable of being master builder. Others blamed Philip for rushing to get the vault finished by Whitson. Some of the masons said the falsework had been taken down before the mortar was properly dry. One old mason said the walls had never been intended to bear the weight of a stone vault. 79 people had been killed, including those who died of their injuries later. Everyone said it would have been more if Prior Philip had not herded so many people to the East End. The priory graveyard was already full because of the fire at the Fleece Fair the previous year, and most of the dead were buried at the parish church. A lot of people said the cathedral was under a curse. Alfred took all his masons off to Shiring, where he was building stone houses for the wealthy townspeople. The other craftsmen drifted away from Kingsbridge. No one was actually dismissed, and Philip continued to pay wages. But there was nothing for the men to do but tidy up the rubble, and after a few weeks they had all gone. No volunteers came to work on Sundays. The market was reduced to a few dispirited stalls, and Malachi packed his family and his possessions onto a huge cart pulled by four oxen and left town, searching for greener pastures. Richard rented his fine black stallion to a farmer, and he and Aliena lived on the proceeds. Without Alfred's support he could not go on as a knight, and in any case there was no point now that William had been made earl. Aliena still felt bound by her vow to her father, but just now there seemed nothing she could do to fulfill it. Richard sank into lethargy. He got up late, sat in the sun most of the day, and spent his evenings in the alehouse. Martha still lived in the big house, alone except for an elderly woman servant. However, she spent most of her time with Aliena. She loved to help with the baby, especially as he looked so much like her adored Jack. She wanted Aliena to call him Jack, but Aliena was reluctant to name him, for reasons she herself did not quite understand. For Aliena, the summer went by in a maternal glow. But when the harvest was in and the weather cooled a little, and the evenings became shorter, she grew discontented. Whenever she thought about her future, Jack came into her mind. He had gone, she had no idea where, and he would probably never come back. But he was still with her, dominating her thoughts, full of life and energy, as clear and vivid to her as if she had seen him only yesterday. She considered moving to another town and pretending she was a widow. She thought of trying to persuade Richard to earn a living somehow. She contemplated doing some weaving, or taking in washing, or becoming a servant to one of the few townspeople who were still wealthy enough to hire help. And each new scheme was greeted with scornful laughter by the imaginary Jack in her head, who said, "Nothing will be any good without me." Making love to Jack on the morning of her marriage to Alfred had been the greatest sin she had ever committed, and she had no doubt that now she was being punished for it. But still, there were times when she felt it was the only good thing she had done in her entire life, and when she looked at her baby, she could not bring herself to regret it. Nevertheless, she was restless. A baby was not enough. She felt incomplete, unfulfilled. Her house seemed too small. Kingsbridge seemed half dead. Life was too uneventful. She became impatient with the baby and snappish with Martha. At the end of the summer, the farmer brought the horse back. It was no longer needed, and suddenly Richard and Aliena had no income. One day in early autumn, Richard went to Shiring to sell his armor. While he was away and Aliena was eating apples for dinner to save money, Jack's mother walked into the house. "Ellen," Aliena said. She was more than startled. There was consternation in her voice, for Ellen had cursed a church wedding, and Prior Philip might yet have her punished for it. "I came to see my grandson," Ellen said calmly. "But how did you know? You hear things, even in the forest." She went over to the cradle in the corner and looked at the sleeping child. Her face softened. "Well, well, there's no doubt about whose son he is. Does he keep well?"
"Never had anything wrong with him. He's small but tough," Aliena said proudly. She added, "like his grandmother."
She studied Ellen. She was leaner than when she had left, and brown-skinned, and she wore a short leather tunic that revealed her tanned calves. Her feet were bare. She looked young and fit. Forest life seemed to suit her. Aliena calculated that she must be 35 years old.
"You seem very well," she said.
"I miss you all," Ellen said. "I miss you and Martha and even your brother Richard. I miss my Jack, and I miss Tom." She looked sad. Aliena was still worried for her safety. "Did anyone see you coming here? The monks might still want to punish you." "There isn't a monk in Kingsbridge who's got the guts to arrest me," she said with a grin. "But I was careful anyway. No one saw me." There was a pause. Ellen looked hard at Aliena. Aliena became slightly uncomfortable under the penetrating stare of Ellen's curious honey-coloured eyes. At last Ellen said, "You're wasting your life."
"What do you mean?"
Aliena said, though Ellen's words had struck a chord instantly. "You should go and find Jack." Aliena felt a pang of delicious hope.
"But I can't," she said.
"Why not?"
"I don't know where he is, for one thing."
"I do." Aliena's heart beat faster. She had thought nobody knew where Jack had gone. It was as if he had vanished off the face of the earth. But now she would be able to imagine him in a specific real place. It changed everything. He might be somewhere nearby. She could show him his baby. Ellen said, "At least I know where he was headed."
"Where?"
Aliena said urgently. "Santiago de Compostela."
"Oh, God."
Her heart sank. She was desperately disappointed. Compostela was the town in Spain where the Apostle James was buried. It was a journey of several months. Jack might as well have been on the far side of the world. Ellen said, "He was hoping to speak to the jongleurs on the road and find out something about his father." Aliena nodded disconsolately. That made sense. Jack had always resented knowing so little about his father. But he might well never return. On such a long journey he was almost certain to find a cathedral he wanted to work on, and then he might settle down. In going to seek his father, he had probably lost his son.
"It's so far away," Aliena said. "I wish I could go after him."
"Why not?" Ellen said. "Thousands of people go there on pilgrimage. Why shouldn't you?"
"I made a vow to my father to take care of Richard until he becomes the Earl," she told Ellen. "I couldn't leave him."
Ellen looked skeptical.
"Just how do you imagine you're helping him at the moment?" she said. "You're penniless, and William is the new Earl. Richard has lost any chance he might have had of regaining the earldom. You're no more use to him here in Kingsbridge than you would be in Compostela. You dedicated your life to that wretched vow. But now there's nothing more you can do. I don't see how your father could reproach you. If you ask me, the greatest favor you could do Richard would be to abandon him for a while, and give him a chance to learn independence." It was true, Aliena thought, that she was no use to Richard at the moment, whether she stayed in Kingsbridge or not. Could it be possible that she was now free? Free to go and find Jack? The mere idea made her heart race. "But I haven't any money to go on pilgrimage," she said.
"What happened to that great big horse?"
"We still have it.
Sell it."
"How can I? It's Richard's."
"For God's sake, who the hell bought it?" Ellen said angrily. "Did Richard work hard for years building up a wool business? Did Richard negotiate with greedy peasants and hard-nosed Flemish buyers? Did Richard collect the wool and store it and set up a market stall and sell it? Don't tell me it's Richard's horse."
"He would be so angry."
"Good. Let's hope he gets angry enough to do some work for the first time in his life." Aliena opened her mouth to argue, then closed it again. Ellen was right. Richard had always relied on her for everything. While he had been fighting for his patrimony, she had been obliged to support him. But now he was not fighting for anything. He had no further claim on her. She imagined meeting Jack again. She visualized his face smiling at her. They would kiss. She felt a stir of pleasure in her loins. She realized she was getting damp down there at the mere thought of him. She felt embarrassed. Ellen said, "Traveling is hazardous, of course." Aliena smiled. "That's one thing I'm not worried about. I've been traveling since I was 17 years old. I can take care of myself. Anyway, there will be hundreds of people on the road to Compostela. You can join with a large pilgrim band. You won't have to travel alone." Aliena sighed. "You know, if I didn't have Baby, I think I'd do it." "It's because of Baby that you must," Ellen said. "He needs a father." Aliena had not looked at it that way. She had been thinking of the journey as purely selfish. Now she saw that the baby needed Jack as much as she did. In her obsession with the day-to-day care of the baby, she had not thought about his future. Suddenly it seemed terribly unfair that he should grow up not knowing the brilliant, unique, adorable genius who was his father. She realized she was talking herself into going, and she felt a thrill of apprehension. A snag occurred to her.
"I couldn't take the baby to Compostela."
Ellen shrugged. "He won't know the difference between Spain and England."
"But you don't have to take him." "What else could I do?"
"Leave him with me. I'll feed him on goat's milk and wild honey." Aliena shook her head.
"I couldn't bear to be parted from him. I love him too much."
"If you love him," Ellen said, "go and find his father." 2. Aliena found a ship at Wareham. When she had crossed to France as a girl with her father, they had gone in one of the Norman warships. These were long, narrow vessels whose sides curved up to a high, sharp point at front and back. They had rows of oars along each side and a square leather sail. The ship that was to take her to Normandy now was similar to those warships, but wider at the waist and deeper to take cargo. It had come from Bordeaux, and she had watched the barefoot sailors unload great casks of wine destined for the cellars of the wealthy. Aliena knew she should leave her baby, but she was heartbroken about it. Every time she looked at him, she rehearsed all the arguments and decided again that she ought to go, and it made no difference. She did not want to part from him. Ellen had come to Wareham with her. Here Aliena had joined up with two monks from Glastonbury Abbey who were going to visit their property in Normandy. Three other people would be passengers on the ship: a young squire who had spent 4 years with an English relative and was returning to his parents in Toulouse, and two young masons who had heard that wages were higher and girls were prettier on the other side of the water. On the morning they were to sail, they all waited in the alehouse while the crew loaded the ship with heavy ingots of Cornish tin. The masons drank several pots of ale, but did not appear to get drunk. Aliena hugged the baby and cried silently. At last, the ship was ready to leave. The sturdy grey mare Aliena had bought in Shiring had never seen the sea and refused to go up the gangplank. However, the squire and the masons collaborated enthusiastically and eventually got the horse on board. Aliena was blinded by tears as she gave her baby to Ellen. Ellen took the baby, but she said, "You can't do this. I was wrong to suggest it." Aliena cried even more.
"But there's Jack," she sobbed. "I can't live without Jack. I know I can't. I must look for him." "Oh, yes," Ellen said. "I'm not suggesting you abandon the trip, but you can't leave your baby behind. Take him with you."
Aliena was flooded with gratitude and cried all the more.
"Do you really think it will be all right?"
"He's been as happy as could be all the way here, riding with you. The rest of the trip will only be more of the same. And he doesn't much like goat's milk." The captain of the vessel said,
"Come on, ladies, the tide's on the turn."
Aliena took the baby back and kissed Ellen.
"Thank you. I'm so happy."
"Good luck," Ellen said. Aliena turned and ran up the gangplank onto the ship. They left immediately. Aliena waved until Ellen was a dot on the quay. As they rowed out of Poole Harbour, it began to rain. There was no shelter up above, so Aliena sat in the bottom with the horses and the cargo. The partial decking on which the oarsmen sat above her head did not completely protect her from the weather, but she was able to keep the baby dry inside her cloak. The motion of the ship seemed to agree with him, and he went to sleep. When darkness fell and the ship anchored, Aliena joined the monks in their prayers. Afterward she dozed fitfully, sitting upright with the baby in her arms. They landed at Barfleur the next day, and Aliena found lodgings in the nearest town, Cherbourg. She spent another day going around the town, speaking to innkeepers and builders, asking if they recalled a young English mason with flaming red hair. Nobody did. There were lots of red-headed Normans, so they might not have noticed him. Or he might have crossed to a different port. Aliena had not realistically expected to find traces of Jack so soon, but nevertheless she was disheartened. On the following day she set off, heading south. She travelled with a seller of knives and his cheerful fat wife and 4 children. They moved quite slowly, and Aliena was happy to keep to their pace and conserve her horse's strength, for it had to carry her a long way. Despite the protection of travelling with a family, She kept her sharp, long-bladed knife strapped up her left sleeve. She did not look rich. Her clothes were warm, but not fancy, and her horse was sturdy rather than spirited. She was careful to keep a few coins handy in a purse, and never show anyone the heavy money belt strapped around her waist underneath her tunic. She fed the baby discreetly, not letting strange men see her breasts. That night she was immensely cheered by a splendid stroke of luck. They stopped at a tiny village called Lesay, and there Aliena met a monk who vividly remembered a young English mason who had been fascinated by the revolutionary new rib vaulting in the Abbey Church. Aliena was exultant. The monk even remembered Jack saying he had landed at Honfleur, which explained why there was no trace of him at Cherbourg. Although it was a year ago, the man talked volubly about Jack and had obviously been charmed by him. Aliena was thrilled to be talking to someone who had seen him. It was confirmation that she was on the right trail. Eventually she left the monk and lay down to sleep on the floor of the abbey guest house. As she drifted off, she hugged the baby tight and whispered into his tiny pink ear, "We're going to find your daddy." The baby fell ill at Tours. The city was wealthy and dirty and crowded. Rats ran in packs around the huge grain stores beside the River Loire. It was full of pilgrims. Tours was a traditional starting point for the pilgrimage to Compostela. In addition, the feast day of St. Martin, the first bishop of Tours, was imminent, and many had come to the abbey church to visit his tomb. Martin was famous for having cut his cloak in two and given half to a naked beggar. Because of the feast, the inns and lodging houses of Tours were packed. Aliena was obliged to take what she could, and she stayed in a ramshackle dockside tavern run by two elderly sisters who were too old and frail to keep the place clean. At first, she did not spend much time at her lodgings. With her baby in her arms, she explored the streets, asking after Jack. She soon realized the city was so constantly full of visitors that the innkeepers could not even remember their guests of the week before last. So there was no point in asking them about someone who might have been here a year ago. However, she stopped at every building site to ask if they had employed a young English mason with red hair called Jack. Nobody had. She was disappointed. She had not heard anything of him since Lesay. If he had stuck to his plan of going to Compostela, he would almost certainly have come to Tours. She began to fear that he might have changed his mind. She went down to the Church of St. Martin, as everyone did, and there she saw a team of builders engaged on extensive repair work. She sought out the master builder, a small, bad-tempered man with thinning hair, and asked if he had employed an English mason. "I never employ the English," he said abruptly, before she had finished her sentence. "English masons are no good." "This one is very good," she said, "and he speaks good French, so you might not have known he's English. He has red hair." "No. Never seen him," the master said rudely and turned away. Aliena went back to her lodgings, somewhat depressed. To be treated nastily for no reason at all was very dispiriting. That night she suffered a stomach upset and got no sleep at all. The next day she felt too ill to go out, and spent all day lying in bed in the tavern. With the stink of the river coming in at the window and the smells of spilled wine and cooking oil seeping up the stairs, on the following morning the baby was ill. He woke her with his crying. It was not his usual lusty, demanding squall, but a thin, weak, sorry complaint. He had the same upset stomach Aliena had, but he was also feverish. His normally alert blue eyes were shut tight in distress, and his tiny hands were clenched into fists. His skin was flushed and blotchy. He had never been ill before, and Aliena did not know what to do. She gave him her breast. He sucked thirstily for a while, then cried again, then sucked again. The milk went straight through him, and seemed to give him no comfort. There was a pleasant young chambermaid working at the tavern, and Aliena asked her to go to the abbey and buy holy water. She considered sending for a doctor, but they always wanted to bleed people, and she could not believe that it would help baby to be bled. The maid returned with her mother, who burned a bunch of dried herbs in an iron bowl. They gave off an acrid smoke that seemed to absorb the bad smells of the place. "The baby will be thirsty. Give him the breast as often as he wants it," she said. "Have plenty to drink yourself.
so that you have enough milk. That's all you can do.
Will he be all right?
Aliena said anxiously.
The woman looked sympathetic.
I don't know, dear. When they are so small, you can't tell. Usually, they survive things like this. Sometimes they don't.
Is he your first?
Yes.
Just remember that you can always have more.
Aliena thought, but this is Jack's baby, and I've lost Jack. She kept her thoughts to herself, thanked the woman, and paid her for the herbs. When they had gone, she diluted the holy water with ordinary water, dipped a rag in it, and cooled the baby's head. He seemed to get worse as the day wore on. Aliena gave him her breast when he cried, sang to him when he lay awake, and cooled him with the holy water when he slept. He suckled continually but fitfully. Fortunately, she had plenty of milk. She always had. She herself was still ill and kept going with dry bread and watered wine. As the hours went by, she came to hate the room she was in, with its bare, fly-blown walls, rough plank floor, ill-fitting door, and mean little window. It had precisely 4 items of furniture: the rickety bed, a 3-legged stool, a clothes pole, and a floor-standing candlestick with 3 prongs but only 1 candle. When darkness fell, the maid came and lit the candle. She looked at the baby who was lying on the bed, waving his arms and legs and grizzling plaintively.
"Poor little thing," she said. "He doesn't understand why he feels so bad."
Aliena moved from the stool to the bed, but she kept the candle burning so that she could see the baby. Through the night they both dozed fitfully. Toward dawn the baby's breathing became shallow, and he stopped crying and moving. Aliena began to cry silently. She had lost Jack's trail, and her baby was going to die here, at a house full of strangers in a city far from home. There would never be another Jack, and she would never have another baby. Perhaps she would die too. That might be for the best. At daybreak she blew out the candle and fell into an exhausted sleep. A loud noise from downstairs woke her abruptly. The sun was up, and the riverside below the window was loudly busy. The baby was dead still, his face peaceful at last. Cold fear gripped her heart. She touched his chest. He was neither hot nor cold. She gasped with fright. Then he gave a deep, shuddering sigh and opened his eyes. Aliena almost fainted with relief. She snatched him up and hugged him, and he began to cry lustily. He was well again, she realized. His temperature was normal, and he was in no distress. She put him to her breast, and he sucked hungrily. Instead of turning away after a few mouthfuls, he carried on, and when one breast was dry, he drained the other. Then he fell into a deep, contented sleep. Aliena realized that her symptoms had gone too, although she felt wrung out. She slept beside the baby until midday, then fed him again. Then she went down to the public room of the tavern and ate a dinner of goat's cheese and fresh bread with a little bacon. Perhaps it was the holy water of St. Martin that had made the baby well. That afternoon she went back to St. Martin's tomb to give thanks to the saint. While she was in the great abbey church, she watched the builders at work, thinking about Jack, who might yet see his baby after all. She wondered whether he had got diverted from his intended route. Perhaps he was working in Paris, carving stones for a new cathedral there. While she was thinking about him, her eye lit on a new corbel being installed by the builders. It was carved with a figure of a man who appeared to be holding the weight of the pillar above on his back. She gasped aloud. She knew instantly, without a shadow of doubt, that the twisted, agonized figure had been carved by Jack. So he had been here. With her heart beating excitedly, she approached the men who were doing the work.
"That corbel," she said breathlessly, "the man who carved it was English, wasn't he?"
An old laborer with a broken nose answered her.
"That's right. Jack Fitzjack did it. Never seen anything like it in my life."
"When was he here?"
Aliena said. She held her breath while the old man scratched his graying head through a greasy cap.
"Must be nearly a year ago now. He didn't stay long, mind. Master didn't like him."
He lowered his voice.
"Jack was too good, if you want to know the truth. He showed the master up, so he had to go."
He laid a finger alongside his nose in a gesture of confidentiality. Aliena said excitedly. Did he say where he was going? The old man looked at the baby.
The child is his, if the hare is anything to go by.
Yes, he is.
Will Jack be pleased to see you, do you think?
Aliena realized the laborer thought Jack might have been running away from her. She laughed.
Oh, yes, she said. He'll be pleased to see me.
He shrugged.
He said he was going to Compostela, for what it's worth.
Thank you,
Aliena said happily, and to the old man's astonishment and delight, she kissed him. The pilgrim trails across France converged at Ostabat, in the foothills of the Pyrenees. There, the group of 20 or so pilgrims with whom Aliena was travelling swelled to about 70. They were a footsore but merry bunch, some prosperous citizens, some probably on the run from justice, a few drunks, and several monks and clergymen. The men of God were there for reasons of piety, but most of the others seemed bent on having a good time. Several languages were spoken, including Flemish, a German tongue, and a southern French language called Occ. Nevertheless, there was no lack of communication among them, and as they crossed the Pyrenees together, they sang, played games, told stories, and, in several cases, had love affairs. After Tours, unfortunately, Aliena did not find any more people who remembered Jack. However, there were not as many jongleurs along her route through France as she had imagined. One of the Flemish pilgrims, a man who had made the journey before, said there would be more of them on the Spanish side of the mountains. He was right. At Pamplona, Aliena was thrilled to find a jongleur who recalled speaking to a young Englishman with red hair, who had been asking about his father. As the weary pilgrims moved slowly through northern Spain toward the coast, she met several more jongleurs, and most of them remembered Jack. She realized with mounting excitement that all of them said he had been going to Compostela. No one had encountered him coming back, which meant he was still there. As her body became more sore, her spirits lifted higher. She could hardly contain her optimism during the last few days of the journey. It was midwinter, but the weather was mild and sunny. The baby, now 6 months old, was fit and happy. She felt sure of finding Jack at Compostela. They arrived there on Christmas Day. They went straight to the cathedral and attended Mass. The church was packed, naturally. Aliena walked round and round the congregation, staring at faces, but Jack was not there. Of course, he was not very devout. In fact, he never went to churches except to work. By the time she had found accommodation, it was dark. She went to bed, but she could hardly sleep for excitement, knowing that Jack was probably within a few steps of where she lay, and tomorrow she would see him and kiss him and show him his baby. She was up at first light. The baby sensed her impatience and nursed irritably, biting her nipples with his gums. She washed him hastily, then went out, carrying him in her arms. As she walked the dusty streets, she expected to see Jack around every corner. How astonished he would be when he caught sight of her, and how pleased. However, she did not see him on the streets, so she began calling at lodging houses. As soon as people started work, she went to building sites and spoke to masons. She knew the words for mason and redhead in the Castilian dialect, and the inhabitants of Compostela were used to foreigners, so she succeeded in communicating. But she found no trace of Jack. She began to be worried. Surely people should know him. He was not the kind of person you could easily overlook, and he must have been living here for several months. She also kept an eye open for his characteristic carvings, but she saw none. Around mid-morning she met a blousy middle-aged woman tavern keeper, who spoke French and remembered Jack.
"A handsome lad. Is he yours? None of the local girls made any progress with him, anyway. He was here at midsummer, but he didn't stay long, more's the pity. He wouldn't say where he was going, either. I liked him. If you find him, give him a big kiss from me."
Aliena went back to her lodgings and lay on the bed, staring at the ceiling. The baby grizzled, but for once she ignored him. She was exhausted, disappointed, and homesick. It was not fair. She had trailed him all the way to Compostela, but he had gone somewhere else. Since he had not gone back to the Pyrenees, and as there was nothing to the west of Compostela but a strip of coastline and an ocean that reached to the end of the world, Jack must have gone farther south. She would have to set off again, on her grey mare, with her baby in her arms, into the heart of Spain. She wondered how far from home she would have to go before her pilgrimage came to an end. Jack spent Christmas Day with his friend Rashid Al-Harun in Toledo. Rashid was a baptized Saracen who had made a fortune importing spices from the East, especially pepper. They met at midday mass in the great cathedral and then strolled back in the warm winter sunshine through the narrow streets and the fragrant bazaar to the wealthy quarter. Rashid's house was made of dazzling white stone and built around a courtyard with a fountain. The shady arcades of the courtyard reminded Jack of the cloisters at Kingsbridge Priory. In England they gave protection from wind and rain, but here their purpose was to deflect the heat of the sun. Rashid and his guests sat on floor cushions and dined off a low table. The men were waited on by the wives and daughters and various servant girls, whose place in the household was somewhat dubious. As a Christian, Rashid could have only one wife, but Jack suspected that he had quietly overlooked the church's disapproval of concubines. The women were the greatest attraction of Rashid's hospitable house. They were all beautiful. His wife was a statuesque, graceful woman with smooth, dark brown skin, lustrous black hair, and liquid brown eyes, and his daughters were slimmer versions of the same type. There were three of them. The eldest was engaged to be married to another dinner guest, the son of a silk merchant in the city. "My Raya is the perfect daughter," Rashid said as she went around the table with a bowl of scented water for the guests to dip their hands in. "She is attentive, obedient, and beautiful. Joseph is a lucky man." The fiancé bowed his head in acknowledgement of his good fortune. The second daughter was proud, even haughty. She appeared to resent the praise lavished on her sister. She looked down at Jack while she poured some kind of drink into his goblet from a copper jug. "What is it?" he said. "Peppermint cordial," she said disdainfully. She disliked waiting on him, for she was the daughter of a great man, and he was a penniless vagabond. It was the third daughter, Aisha, whom Jack liked most. In the 3 months he had been here, he had got to know her quite well. She was 15 or 16 years old, small and lively, always grinning. Although she was 3 or 4 years younger than he, she did not seem juvenile. She had a lively, questioning intelligence. She asked him endless questions about England and the different way of life there. She often made fun of Toledo's society manners, the snobbery of the Arabs, the fastidiousness of the Jews, and the bad taste of the newly rich Christians, and she sometimes had Jack in fits of laughter. Although she was the youngest, she seemed the least innocent of the three. Something about the way she looked at Jack as she leaned over him to place a dish of spicy prawns on the table unmistakably revealed the licentious streak. She caught his eye and said, "Peppermint cordial," in a perfect imitation of her sister's snooty manner. And Jack giggled. When he was with Aisha, he could often forget Aliena for hours at a time. But when he was away from this house, Aliena was on his mind as much as if he had left her only yesterday. His memories of her were painfully vivid, although he had not seen her for more than a year. He could recall any of her expressions at will, laughing, thoughtful, suspicious, anxious, pleased, astonished, and, clearest of all, passionate. He had forgotten nothing about her body, and he could still see the curve of her breast, feel the soft skin on the inside of her thigh, taste her kiss, and smell the scent of her arousal. He often longed for her. To cure himself of his fruitless desire, he sometimes imagined what Aliena must be doing. In his mind's eye he would see her pulling Alfred's boots off at the end of the day, sitting down to eat with him, kissing him, making love to him, and giving her breast to a baby boy who looked just like Alfred. These visions tortured him but did not stop him from longing for her. Today, Christmas Day, Aliena would roast a swan and redress it with its feathers for the table, and there would be posset to drink, made of ale, eggs, milk, and nutmeg. The food in front of Jack could not have been more different. There were mouth-watering dishes of strangely spiced lamb, rice mixed with nuts, and salads dressed with lemon juice and olive oil. It had taken Jack a while to get used to Spanish cooking. They never served the great joints of beef, legs of pork, and haunches of venison, without which no feast was complete in England, nor did they consume thick slabs of bread. They did not have the lush pastures for grazing vast herds of cattle, or the rich soil on which to grow fields of waving wheat. They made up for the relatively small quantities of meat by imaginative ways of cooking it with all kinds of spices, and in place of the ubiquitous bread of the English, they had a wide variety of vegetables and fruits. Jack was living with a small group of English clerics in Toledo. They were part of an international community of scholars that included Jews, Muslims, and Arab Christians. The Englishmen were occupied translating works of mathematics from Arabic into Latin, so they could be read by Christians. There was an atmosphere of feverish excitement among them, as they discovered and explored the treasure house of Arab learning, and they had casually welcomed Jack as a student. They admitted into their circle anyone who understood what they were doing, and shared their enthusiasm for it. They were like peasants who have labored for years to scratch a crop out of poor soil, and then suddenly moved to a rich alluvial valley. Jack had abandoned building to study mathematics. He had not yet needed to work for money. The clerics casually gave him a bed and any meals he wanted, and they would have provided him with a new robe and sandals if he had needed them. Rashid was one of their sponsors. As an international trader, he was multilingual and cosmopolitan in his attitudes. At home he spoke Castilian, the language of Christian Spain, rather than Mozarabic. His family also all spoke French, the language of the Normans, who were important traders. Although he was a man of commerce, he had a powerful intellect and a wide-ranging curiosity. He loved to talk to scholars about their theories. He had taken a liking to Jack immediately, and Jack dined at his house several times a week. Now, as they began to eat, Rashid asked Jack, "What have the philosophers taught us this week?" "I've been reading Euclid." Euclid's Elements of Geometry had been one of the first books translated. "Euclid is a funny name for an Arab," said Ismail, Rashid's brother. "He was Greek," Jack explained. "He lived before the birth of Christ. His work was lost by the Romans, but preserved by the Egyptians, so it comes to us in Arabic." "And now Englishmen are translating it into Latin," Rashid said. "This amuses me." "But what have you learned?" said Joseph, the fiancé of Raya. Jack hesitated. It was hard to explain. He tried to make it practical. "My stepfather, the builder, taught me how to perform certain operations in geometry, how to divide a line exactly in half, how to draw a right angle, and how to draw one square inside another so that the smaller is half the area of the larger." "What is the purpose of such skills?" Joseph interrupted. There was a note of scorn in his voice. He saw Jack as something of an upstart and was jealous of the attention Rashid paid to Jack's conversation. "Those operations are essential in planning buildings," Jack replied pleasantly, pretending not to notice Joseph's tone. "Take a look at this courtyard. The area of the covered arcades around the edges is exactly the same as the open area in the middle. Most small courtyards are built like that, including the cloisters of monasteries. It's because these proportions are most pleasing. If the middle is bigger, it looks like a marketplace, and if it's smaller, it just looks as if there's a hole in the roof. But to get it exactly right, the builder has to be able to draw the open part in the middle so that it's precisely half the area of the whole thing."
"I never knew that,"
Rashid said triumphantly. He liked nothing better than to learn something new. "Euclid explains why these techniques work," Jack went on. "For example, the two parts of the divided line are equal because they form corresponding sides of congruent triangles." "Congruent?" Rashid queried. "It means exactly alike."
"Ah!
Now I see." However, no one else did, Jack could tell. Joseph said,
"But you could perform all these geometric operations before you read Euclid, so I don't see that you're any better off now."
Rashid protested. "A man is always better off for understanding something. Jack said, Besides, now that I understand the principles of geometry, I may be able to devise solutions to new problems that baffled my stepfather. He felt rather frustrated by the conversation. Euclid had come to him like the blinding flash of a revelation, but he was failing to communicate the thrilling importance of these new discoveries. He changed tack somewhat. It's Euclid's method that is the most interesting, he said. He takes five axioms, self-evident truths, and deduces everything else logically from them. Give me an example of an axiom, Rashid said. A line can be prolonged indefinitely. No, it can't, said Aisha, who was handing round a bowl of figs. The guests were somewhat startled to hear a girl joining in the argument, but Rashid laughed indulgently. Aisha was his favourite. And why not? He said. It has to come to an end sometime, she said. Jack said, But in your imagination, it could go on indefinitely. In my imagination, water could flow uphill and dogs speak Latin, she retorted. Her mother came into the room and heard that rejoinder.
Aisha,
she said in a steely voice.
Out!
All the men laughed. Aisha made a face and went out. Joseph's father said, Whoever marries her will have his hands full. They laughed again. Jack laughed too. Then he noticed they were all looking at him, as if the joke was on him. After dinner, Rashid showed off his collection of mechanical toys. He had a tank in which you could mix water and wine, and they would come out separately. A marvelous water-driven clock, which kept track of the hours in the day with phenomenal accuracy. A jug that would refill itself but never overflow, and a small wooden statue of a woman with eyes made of some kind of crystal that absorbed water in the warmth of the day and then shed it in the cool of the evening so that she appeared to be weeping. Jack shared Rashid's fascination with these toys, but he was most intrigued by the weeping statue, for whereas the mechanisms of the others were simple once they had been explained, no one really understood how the statue worked. They sat in the arcades around the courtyard in the afternoon, playing games, dozing, or talking idly. Jack wished he belonged to a big family like this one, with sisters and uncles and in-laws, and a family home they could all visit, and a position of respect in a small town. Suddenly he recalled the conversation he had had with his mother, the night she rescued him from the Priory punishment cell. He had asked her about his father's relations, and she had said yes. He had a big family back in France. I have got a family like this one somewhere, Jack realized. My father's brothers and sisters are my uncles and aunts. I might have cousins of my own age. I wonder if I will ever find them. He felt adrift. He could survive anywhere, but he belonged nowhere. He had been a carver, a builder, a monk, and a mathematician, and he did not know which was the real Jack, if any. He sometimes wondered if he should be a jongleur like his father, or an outlaw like his mother. He was 19 years old, homeless and rootless, with no family and no purpose in life. He played chess with Joseph and won. Then Rashid came up and said, Give me your chair, Joseph. I want to hear more about Euclid. Joseph obediently gave up his chair to his prospective father-in-law, then moved away. He had already heard everything he ever wanted to know about Euclid. Rashid sat down and said to Jack, You're enjoying yourself? Your hospitality is matchless, Jack said smoothly. He had learned courtly manners in Toledo. Thank you, but I meant with Euclid. Yes, I don't think I succeeded in explaining the importance of this book. You see, I think I understand, Rashid said. Like you. I love knowledge for its own sake. Yes. Even so, every man has to make a living. Jack did not see the relevance of that remark, so he waited for Rashid to say more. However, Rashid sat back with his eyes half closed, apparently content to enjoy a companionable silence. Jack began to wonder whether Rashid was reproaching him for not working at a trade. Eventually Jack said, I expect I shall go back to building one day. Good. Jack smiled. When I left Kingsbridge, Riding my mother's horse with my stepfather's tools in a satchel slung across my shoulder, I thought there was only one way to build a church. Thick walls with round arches and small windows topped by a wooden ceiling or a barrel-shaped stone vault. The cathedrals I saw on my way from Kingsbridge to Southampton taught me no different. But Normandy changed my life.
I can imagine, Rashid said sleepily. He was not very interested, so Jack recalled those days in silence.
Within hours of landing at Honfleur, he was looking at the Abbey Church of Jumièges. It was the highest church he had ever seen, but otherwise it had the usual round arches and wooden ceiling, except in the chapter house, where Abbot Urso had built a revolutionary stone ceiling. Instead of a smooth, continuous barrel or a creased groin vault, this ceiling had ribs which sprang up from the tops of the columns and met at the apex of the roof. The ribs were thick and strong, and the triangular sections of ceiling between the ribs were thin and light. The monk, who was keeper of the fabric, explained to Jack that it was easier to build that way. The ribs were put up first, and the sections between were then simpler to make. This type of vault was also lighter. The monk was hoping to hear news from Jack of technical innovations in England, and Jack had to disappoint him. However, Jack's evident appreciation of rib vaulting pleased the monk, and he told Jack that there was a church at Lacey not far away that had rib vaulting throughout. Jack went to Lacey the next day and spent all afternoon in the church, staring in wonder at the vault. What was so striking about it, he finally decided, was the way the ribs coming down from the apex of the vault to the capitals on top of the columns seemed to dramatize the way the weight of the roof was being carried by the strongest members. The ribs made the logic of the building visible. Jack traveled south to the county of Anjou and got a job doing repair work at the Abbey Church in Tours. He had no trouble persuading the master builder to give him a trial. The tools he had in his possession showed that he was a mason, and after a day at work, the master knew he was a good one. His boast to Aliena that he could get work anywhere in the world was not entirely vain. Among the tools he had inherited was Tom's foot rule. Only master builders owned these, and when the others discovered Jack had one, they asked him how he had become a master at such a young age. His first inclination was to explain that he was not really a master builder, but then he decided to say he was. After all, he had effectively run the Kingsbridge site while he was a monk, and he could draw plans just as well as Tom. But the master he was working for was annoyed to discover that he had hired a possible rival. One day Jack suggested a modification to the monk in charge of the building, and drew what he meant on the tracing floor. That was the beginning of his troubles. The master builder became convinced that Jack was after his job. He began to find fault with Jack's work, and put him on the monotonous task of cutting plain blocks. Soon Jack set off again. He went to the Abbey of Cluny, the headquarters of a monastic empire that spread all across Christendom. It was the Cluniac order that had initiated and fostered the now famous pilgrimage to the tomb of St. James at Compostela. All along the Compostela road, there were churches dedicated to St. James and Cluniac monasteries to take care of pilgrims. As Jack's father had been a jongleur on the pilgrim road, it seemed likely he had visited Cluny. However, he had not. There were no jongleurs at Cluny. Jack learned nothing about his father there. Nevertheless, the journey was by no means wasted. Every arch Jack had ever seen, until the moment he entered the Abbey Church of Cluny, had been semicircular, and every vault had been either tunnel-shaped, like a line of round arches all stuck together, or groined, like the crossing where two tunnels met. The arches at Cluny were not semicircular. They rose to a point. There were pointed arches in the main arcades. The groined vaults of the side aisles had pointed arches, and, most startling of all, above the nave there was a stone ceiling that could only be described as a pointed barrel vault. Jack had always been taught that a circle was strong because it was perfect, and a round arch was strong because it was part of a circle. He would have thought that pointed arches were weak. In fact, the monks told him, the pointed arches were considerably stronger than the old round ones. The church at Cluny seemed to prove it, for despite the great weight of stonework and its peaked vault, it was very high. Jack did not stay long at Cluny. He continued south, following the pilgrim road, diverging whenever the whim took him. In the early summer there were jongleurs all along the route, in the larger towns or near the Cluniac monasteries. They